The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Bonsoir.
Good evening.
Monsieur Valois,
I am Jacques Lambert.
I have been following your research online for months. I have a keen interest in the sword.
Theo?
The sword is not for sale.
I wager you'll hand over the sword for a kidney.
Monsieur Valois, is it you?
Oui, it is real, Anya. The sword has been found.
D'Artagnan's sword.
Are you going to check to see if it is in there?
It's a rolled parchment.
The map to the real treasure.
I'm guessing this map is the labyrinthine aqueducts beneath the city.
Come along, Anya. La vie est souterrain.
What an appropriately macabre place for the queen to leave a treasure. Asher, did you hear that? What do you think it was?
Probably just rats.
I don't think so.
You know, I do not like you, Lambert.
Give me the map.
Theo.
Off your goons, Lambert.
He is expendable.
Kill him!
No!
Anya, leave me. I'm dying.
Hang in there, Asher. You can do this.
I've been expecting you.
Then I'll get you, Lambert. All this is for what?
I've got my eye on a new treasure. It is another sword. A magical one.
You believe in magic?
I know, Anya. I know.
You know nothing.
I will have the sword. Touché.
Rogue Angel 15. Swordsman's Legacy. From Graphic Audio.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Well, that's funny. The door's open. Hello? Miss Sally? Sally? Sally, wake up! Please! Please wake up!
Smoke?
Stay right here, Miss Sally. Just hang on, okay?
Lapeer, Moore, and Daggett. Never heard of them. But they're damn sure gonna hear from me.
Take them damn guns off, and I'll show you what a real man can do.
I'll take them off anytime you're ready, donkey face.
About right now, cowboy. Outside.
Suits me, lard ass.
All right now. Are you ready to get your...
I just blew the bank building, John. Goddamn heathen! Come on, you sonny scum!
Now we all find out something I've always known.
What's that? Your Majesty.
Who's the better man, of course?
Hell, Davidson! I've known that since the first time I laid eyes on you. You couldn't shine my boots.
Forward, troops! Advance and wipe out the Mongols!
Let's go, boys.
From Big Rock, Colorado to Keene, New Hampshire and back again. Smoke is blazing, a bloody trail of retribution. In Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man 4, Revenge of the Mountain Man. Available now from Graphic Audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Thomas Penny, Michael John Casey, Mort Shelby, David Coyne, Andy Clements, Jeff Baker, Elizabeth Demery, Ken Jackson, and Casey Platt. Deathlands number 84, Plague Lords.
When a mosquito speared Oki Moore right between the eyes, he deftly squashed it against his forehead. Blood from the bug's crushed abdomen trickled in a cool bead down the side of his nose. He wiped it across his cheek with the back of his hand, smearing a fresh daub of red into the impasto of squashed bodies, legs, wings, tiny gobs of black mush trapped in the hairs of his beard. A cloud of bugs wheeled around his head. Mosquitoes broke formation and dive-bombed him in waves, trying to get at his earlobes, but they were protected by his greasy, shoulder-length hair.
Oki watched the fire talkers rap in exaggerated gestures. He was the evening's featured entertainment.
The young'un, squatting in the sand next to him, moved a dozen steps to the right, into the shifting river of smoke that poured off the communal bonfire, the Skeeter no-fly zone. The air this particular evening was heavy with bugs and moisture. That and the smothering heat made deep breathing difficult. Circled around the campfire were more than 200 filthy people in brand new matching clothing. The men, women, and older children wore baggy, gaudy Hawaiian-style shirts and shorts, still creased from the packaging, and gleaming white high-top basketball shoes. The toe boxes of the women's and kids' shoes were crammed with rags to make them fit. Well-oiled AKMs, semi-auto pistols, slide-action shotguns, and heavy machine guns all stood close to hand, shoulder slung or holstered, or tripod swivel mounted to spray 180 degrees of water approach with pre-dark alloys of lead. The price of sitting on a gold mine was eternal vigilance. And the gold mine in question was above ground and visible for miles in all directions. In the furious aftermath of Armageddon, the Yoko Maru, a container ship loaded with substandard U.S. market reject merchandise bound for Brazil, had been driven high and dry onto the shoal of Padre Island. The narrow slip of Padre, once 200 miles long, had been crosscut by Category 7 storms into a chain of hundreds of smaller landmasses and barely submerged sandy reefs. The little landmass that Oki and his clan shared with the Yoko Maru stood directly opposite the entrance to Corpus Christi Bay, which had expanded to drown the low-lying Texas port community of the same name. Tidal waves had swept away the pillars and roadway of JFK Causeway Bridge that once connected Padre to the mainland. Post-nuke cost, the only access to the island was by boat. News along the ruined Atlantic and Gulf coasts was fragmentary and transmitted by word of mouth from passing traders and wandering storytellers. These infrequent campfire soliloquies were the only entertainment on offer. The fire talkers swapped their tales for grub, joy juice, and the gratis services of gaudy sluts. On Padre, guest speakers who failed to sufficiently amuse faced a long, almost always fatal, forced swim back to the mainland. The fire talker's arms swept skyward.
And then the Vikings jumped in their time dilator and took their war to Mars. They're the ones who made the stickies and scalies, the talking lungfish and the celery people. It was part of their ancient Norse magic. what they call the Runestone Concatenation. And their minions launched a devastating counterattack against the Iroquois Ninja Princess's cloud operatives.
For nuke's sake, get to the fucking point!
What about those fucking raiders? The Matachin? That's what we want to hear about.
I'm coming to them. Patience, my friends, patience. Past is prologue. It's important that you're brought up to speed on the real background of recent events.
Oki noted the half-hearted way the Fire Talker fanned at the swirling mass of Skeeter circling his head and shoulders. He didn't squash a single one, nor did he manage to dislodge the legions feeding on his bare arms and shoulders and speckling his uncovered legs. The Fire Talker bore a vague resemblance to a picture Oki and the others had seen before. It had been stuck inside 10,000 thin, clear plastic cases they'd found in one of the Yokomaru's cargo containers. The pre-dark image was of a brilliantly smiling, block-headed guy with a dark, stubby beard and eyelashes that were way too long and lush. George Mackerel? Or was it Mackerel George? Oki couldn't recall. No one on Padre Island had had a clue what the silver discs inside the cases were for. The island's kids had torn open the cases and used the discs as flying toys. The litter of picture inserts had long since vanished, turned to pulp by a torrential rain, and washed out to sea. The CDs were still in evidence, stomped to silver bits, and scattered through the sand.
Cloud operatives are pulling all the strings from their base behind the moon.
But you just said they was pawns.
No, I said they might be pawns. Obviously, there's a big difference.
You didn't say might.
Yes, I did.
No, you didn't.
What an asshole!
Oki had had enough of the tap dancing, too. Stepping forward, he thrust a grimy finger in the Fire Talker's face.
Isabelville! Brownsville! Motherfucking Morrisville! Tell us about something real, Mr. Mackerel George! Or you're going skinny dipping with sharks!
Easy there, friend. I'm getting to it.
Well, get faster. Word is them scumbag pirate Matachin have raided from Cancun to Veracruz and are headed this way. You said you was from there? So what the fucking fire blast is going on?
The Fire Talker flashed Oki a big, pearly-toothed grin.
The Matachin attacked Brownsville and Matamorisville 9 days ago. They came in a fleet of tugboats, half a dozen at least, motored top speed right up the mouth of the Grandy.
They were under engine power? No one has that kind of gas anymore.
Engine and Viking power. Stacks pumping out dark brown smoke in broad daylight, horns wailing, firing cannons mounted fore and aft. Their allies, the Vikings, manipulated the virtual time continuum along the meridian lines, the power grids of Earth's magnetic core, and turned the sky black and the sea red. Just imagine the Ville folks' fear. Imagine their horror when the darkness and death fell upon them. The Matachin shelled the perimeter defenses with high explosives. Brownsville folk only had small arms and a few homie bombs. They couldn't make a dent in the attackers, couldn't turn them back. After cannon shells breached the berm, the pirates started lobbing explosives into the Ville proper. Fire started up and spread, flames leaping high into that awful black sky. The smart folks ran north, left behind everything they had. They got out before the Matachin landing parties hit the beach. The pirates wore special suits and helmets manufactured on Mars and given to them by the Vikings. Even bullets fired at close range can't penetrate the overlapping plates of armor. When the gates of the Ville came down, then came the slaughter fest and the sacking.
Oki looked around the ring and saw doubting, distrustful, angry faces. He and his fellow Nuevo Texicans were a hard-bitten realist crew, habitually cautious, naturally suspicious. Even though they lived in a garbage dump, they could tell when something didn't smell right.
So you're saying the Vikings are trying to take over Deathlands because of this time doohickey?
No! They are servants of the Martian hordes. Vikings are just ancient barbarians who were allowed access to deep space technology, or DST, as I already explained. Do you want me to explain it again in more detail?
Oki glared. As a fire talker, Mackerel George was a flop. If he had any pertinent information, it was buried under tons of indecipherable bullshit. The story had no characters, no great battles, no romance, no titillating sex. It was just dry, boring history. So-and-so did this, then so-and-so did that. One loony idea spiraling off into the next, heading in five directions at once, and complicated by big word double talk and constant self-corrections. Oki should have seen the handwriting on the wall the first time the nuke-brained idiot mentioned the celery people. The islanders had had enough. Adults and children started pushing up from their plastic lawn chairs. Only the handful of droolies among them wore eager grins. They were eating it up, which saved everyone else from having to amuse the shit-stained crazies. That sorry respite was all that stood between the fire talker and a fatal swim. Daniel DeCipio pressed a palm against the gritty roof of an overturned cargo container, bracing himself, his homemade VDU shorts down around his duct-taped boot tops. The can of pre-dark pork and beans the islanders had rewarded him with had tasted like sweetened red chalk, washed down with a half cup of harsh joy juice that stung his tongue to numbness. And now, the pièce de résistance, an oral servicing by a toothless hag of a gaudy slut. Looking down at her bobbing gray-haired head, Daniel decided it wasn't dark enough out, not by half. He tightly closed his eyes and tried to imagine a hot young MTV star of his own era. The calluses on her tongue and the insides of her cheeks kept ruining his fantasy. In the midst of this joyless congress, he caught himself replaying the evening's events, a familiar unfolding, helplessly watching an audience lose interest in his narrative, fielding their angry questions and challenges, watching them melt into the darkness. It was his former life all over again. Almost. The big wheel of karma had turned, but not in the way he or Creedence Clearwater Revival had anticipated. This time, there was payback. Unimaginable payback. Daniel didn't swat the bugs that landed ever so lightly on his face and arms. The welts raised by their bites camouflaged the tiny red whorls that dotted the surface of his skin. Freezer burn from a century spent in the narrow confines of a cryo tank. He let the skeeters have a good deep taste of his tainted blood, then gently fanned them away. He didn't want the bugs to get too full. After whetting their stabbers on him, they attacked the kneeling slut. His disgruntled audience had gone back to their shacks and lean-tos, with clouds of similarly infected mosquitoes hovering over their heads and shoulders. Daniel had no feelings of remorse, no pangs of conscience over what he had done to them. In fact, he gloried in it. The big wheel had remade him. It had given him a destiny worthy of his talent for the epic and the tragic. He was Satan's sword, cleaving the multitudes. A transformation that gave new meaning to the 20th century catchphrase, knocked them dead. Over Ryan Cotter's right shoulder, five scattered, flickering, orange-red suns dawned along the horizon line to the south, sandwiched between greasy black sea and menacing black sky. Across the expanse of flat water, maybe 10 miles away, a string of Gulf Coast oil rigs still burned, as they had day and night for more than a century. In the distance ahead of the one-eyed warrior, the real sun, immense and an even bloodier red, squashed into an ovoid by atmospheric distortion, struggled up from deep purple night. Ryan and his five companions ran east through the slowly lifting darkness. They drove themselves at a brutal and unforgiving pace down the ruin of an ancient asphalt road. Running through the Deathlands at night and over unfamiliar ground was risky business. In this case, not running was far riskier. For 2.5 hours, they had been hard at it. Jack Lauren was on point. Ryan could see him silhouetted by the hell ball of the emerging sun, his shoulder-length mane of white hair flying, his magnum Colt Python in his fist. In wire-rimmed spectacles and screwed-on fedora, The diminutive J.B. Dix held down the column's rear with his M4000 12-gauge pump. Ryan's lover, the long-legged Christy Roth, jogged on his left with her Smith & Wesson Model 640 38-caliber revolver in hand. Christy's emerald eyes searched the dim verge of the roadway ahead, her red, prehensile muti hair drawn up into tight curls of alarm. Ryan carried his Sig Sauer P226 with a 9mm round chambered, safety off, index finger stiffened outside the trigger guard. His prized long rifle, a scoped Steyr SSG-70 sniper rifle, was strapped tightly over his shoulder and back by its sling. Behind Ryan and Christy, in the middle of the pack, were the group's pair of time travelers. Theophilus Algernon Tanner had been ripped from the bosom of his young family in the late 1880s, time-trawled against his will by the whitecoats of Operation Kronos. Caught in their net, he had been dragged forward to 1998, the first subject to survive the time travel experiment. If the whitecoats expected their Victorian lab rat to appreciate the big picture and be grateful for the sake of science and the expansion of knowledge, they were very much disappointed. Shortly before Armageddon, to be rid of him and as punishment for his truculence, the whitecoat sent the Harvard and Oxford-educated scholar forward in time again. It was an act of cruelty that had saved his life. Doc Tanner didn't look over 200 years old. He looked a fit 60, and his biological age was actually mid-30s. His teeth were still excellent. A tall scarecrow in a tattered frock coat and tall leather boots, he loped with a sheathed ebony sword cane in one hand and his massive Civil War-era pistol in the other. Beside him, Dr. Mildred Wyeth kept pace, ready to cut loose, deadly accurate with her 38-caliber Checkmate ZKR 551 target revolver, the same make and model weapon that had helped her earn a freestyle shooting silver medal in the last ever Olympic Games. The African-American physician had been cryogenically frozen on December 28, 2000, a few weeks prior to Skydark, after an adverse reaction to anesthetic during surgery. Dr. Wyeth had slept in suspended animation for more than a century before the companions freed her. Like Tanner, Mildred was still in her mid-30s, biologically speaking.
Along the shoulders of both sides of the road, thorny, tangled scrub brush grew waist high. The unbroken walls of cover were made to order for a close-range crossfire and ambush.
Using the pre-dark Matran system was always a gamble, because so many things could go wrong, mid-jump and post-jump. This time they had materialized in a pitch-black East Texas redoubt, perilously close to the Houston nuke blast Ground Zero. Using precious flashlight batteries for illumination, they had attempted to jump again, but the system wouldn't power up. They tried the last destination button with the same result. They were stuck and in the dark. The redoubt's lights wouldn't come on either. Apparently, the nuke reactor had had one last burst of power left in it. They were damned lucky to have materialized at all. To conserve their batteries, they had lit torches made of paper, cardboard, and rags, whatever debris they could find, and explored the deserted underground complex, looking for a way out. The reason why nothing worked soon became apparent. High water marks stained the walls near the ceiling. The redoubt had been flooded at some time in the past. Dried mud, like beige talcum powder, coated walls, floors, computers, desktops, overturned chairs, and the crumbling litter of printout paper. Corrosive salts from the water had etched silicon chips and circuit boards into junk. In a side room, they found a 3D plastic topographic map of the Houston area, all the way to the Gulf Coast. On the opposite wall was a row of large glass-faced dials. JB and Ryan had brushed the dried mud from the faces of the dials and the engraved plastic labels beneath them. The units were radiation counters, connected to distant remote sensors. The nameplates read Central Houston, South Houston, Bunker Hill Village, Lynchburg, LaPorte. The counters were non-functional. All but one of the needles was pinned in the red. The Barrett dial was stuck in mid-arc, which had two possible meanings. That area had been hit by less radiation on nuke day, or the dial's mechanism had broken, and its needle had fallen back from the little post at the far edge of the red. Because the companions had no alternative, they took it to mean the former, that the Barrett direction was the only safe corridor leading away from Ground Zero. Every second they remained in the hot spot, they got a bigger dose of radiation. Even though it was the middle of the night, they had to go, and go quickly. Ryan swept his gaze along the ever-brightening terrain. So far, so good on not being attacked, So his mind went back to chew on their other problem. Though they had water and jerky left in their packs, it wasn't enough to fuel a multi-day journey, not when they were running full tilt. The gathering Texas dawn revealed a flat, featureless landscape, a plain of dense, twisted, black vegetation that the rising sun could not brighten or penetrate. To Ryan, the sea of brush looked like it had been burned by a terrible wildfire, but he knew it hadn't. The cruelly spiked scrub had sprung from the ashes of Armageddon, a stubborn mutation that defied the effects of toxic soil, air, and water. Its fat, lobe-shaped fruits, a gaudy orange and bigger than a man's fist, hung in heavy clusters and lay in scattered, rotting piles along the shoulder. In the motionless air, they gave off a sickeningly sweet smell, like an exploded joy juice still. Food gathering was not an option for them. They were too close to the Houston craters. The fruit wasn't safe to eat. And they had to cover as much ground as they could before the day really heated up and the threat of death by dehydration forced them to stop and find shade until evening. Ryan decided that they had made the right choice in direction. The broken road they ran over seemed well-traveled. Narrow, knobby tires had gouged countless crisscrossing ruts in the black asphalt sand.
Okay, hold up. Jack, come on back.
The companions slowed to a stop and holstered their weapons as the pale teenager loped back to join them. Ryan stretched. Beads of perspiration trickled in a steady stream from his hairline, following the ragged edge of the welt of scar that split his left eyebrow. He wiped away the sweat to keep it from seeping under the black eye patch he wore and burning into the socket emptied by a knife slash years ago.
So, Jack, what's up ahead?
Land goes up. Saw the road goes off to the right. Whole lot of nothing.
Show us.
With Jack in the lead, the companions walked up the slight grade to where the roadbed curved to the right and began a long, straight descent through the stands of black scrub. Looking east from the highest point, Ryan saw that the horizon was pale brown, not black. The scrub dead-ended in what appeared to be a definite borderline. He remembered a north-south running river valley from the redoubt's topo map. The brown had to be that valley. There was no hint of green life ahead, just a beige flatland of bare dirt and rock. No ambush to worry about. No shade, either.
Staying here isn't an option. Let's move.
After another mile, when they were back on the flat, but still 5 or 6 miles from the riverbed, Ryan held up his hand, the whole group coming to a stop.
You hear that, JB?
Yeah, I do. And it... Oh, God!
Ryan glanced at JB, but then the breeze shifted, and he too was hit by a wall of stench, a caustic, invisible fog. It was the hellscape's unmistakable signature scent, ruination, the choking, searing off-gases of biological decay. Jack drew his Colt Python. The others pulled their weapons and advanced with caution. Ryan looked over Jack's slim shoulder at what lay on the road ahead. Under a haze of flying insects, half-naked bodies, at least 20 of them, were scattered from one side to the other. Some face up, some face down. Pale skin was blotched purple and black. The flesh looked semi-soft, like it was melting from the bones. The torsos and limbs were grotesquely bloated. Bipedal corpses, but definitely not Norm.
Stickies.
Jack led the others into the obstacle course of decomposition and swarming insects. Legions of hairy black flies crawled in and out of the nose holes, and in and out of lipless gaping maws lined with rows of black-edged needle teeth. Emptied eye sockets were packed with masses of juddering bugs, feeding, fighting, egg-laying. Holding her kerchief tight to her face, her eyes watering from the stench, Mildred stopped and knelt beside one of the bodies. Ryan could see the mutie's mouth and facial bones had partially dissolved. The inward collapse created a caldera effect in the hairless flab. The creature's bare, distended belly had burst a yawning seam right up the middle.
No way of telling what chilled them or when. Daytime temperature's got to be over 100 degrees around here. And they've been cooking on the black sand.
They rot quick, too.
Even in cold weather, dead stickies dissolve like burning candles.
They could have eaten the fruit and gotten poisoned, or they could have died from gunshot.
Mildred stood up, backing away to slightly fresher air. Christy fanned flies from her eyes and frowned.
The damned bugs are eating the bodies and they aren't dead.
Neither are the wireworms.
JB gestured with the muzzle of his Smith & Wesson's scattergun. Between the lips of the gaping fissure that ran from the corpse's pubis to sternum, a bolus of the blood-washed, hair-fine parasites squirmed weakly.
It wasn't blasters that chilled them. No empty shell casings on the road. No bullet holes in the muties, either.
Could be their breeders.
During certain times of the year, the friends had encountered an odd mating ritual. Stickies swept across the hellscape in a living wave, gathering numbers to breed. Some, like these perhaps, dropped dead of exertion along the way. The muties mated en masse, indiscriminately, for days at a time. To be caught in the path of their sexual rampage meant horrible death. Not just from the needle teeth. Stickies had adhesive glands in their palms, and their fingers were lined with tiny suckers. They killed by pulling their victims limb from limb.
Maybe the rest have already passed us by. Maybe we've missed them?
They're in front of us, then. They could be anywhere ahead.
Maybe so, but we've got no choice. We've got to keep following the road east. We can't bust that black brush without getting torn to shreds, and we sure as hell can't go back the way we came.
JB checked his weapon, cracking the combat pump gun's action just enough to see the rim of a chambered high-brass buckshot round. Snapping the slide forward, he flicked his glasses back to the bridge of his nose.
Guess we'd better get on with it, then.
They were about a quarter mile from the black to brown color change when small arms fire erupted in the near distance ahead. At the sudden noise, JB, Doc, and Mildred ducked to the left shoulder, Ryan, Christy, and Jack to the right. Crouching, weapons up, in an instant they were ready to pour withering fire down the road.
They're not shooting at us.
Perhaps another band of travelers has been set upon by the stickies.
If they've got that many bullets to burn, they've probably got extra food and water.
I scout ahead.
Ryan reached out a hand and stopped Jack, who was already moving forward.
No wreck. There's no point. We've got nowhere to retreat. Whatever's up ahead, we've got to get past it. We need to go in full force.
They advanced, low and fast, along the highway shoulder. Down the road, at the horizon line, a huge plume of off-white smoke and beige dust billowed skyward. Ryan frowned. It was hard to imagine Deathland's motorbike traders blowing each other up over a few knapsacks of pre-dark spoils. High explosives were far too valuable to waste. As the gunshots dwindled, it seemed that the tide of battle had turned, or the combatants had managed to destroy each other. Either way, there would be less argument over who owned what when the companions burst onto the scene. Another column of smoke slowly snaked up in front of them. This plume was oily black, and much skinnier, the source hidden down in the river valley, below their line of sight. The roadway ended abruptly just beyond the start of the bridge deck in a ragged lip of asphalt and concrete. The 500-yard-long structure had collapsed, probably shaken apart by shockwaves on nuke day. The tops of the bridge's massive support pillars stretched off in a straight line to the far side of the gorge. They were crowned by short sections of broken-off highway and guardrail. There were yawning, impassable gaps between them. Unslinging the styre and flipping up the lens cover of its scope, Ryan crept forward, past the bike trails that had been worn into the hardpan on either side of the collapsed roadway. He peered over the verge on one knee, bringing the rifle's buttstock to his shoulder. There were two parallel north-south running slopes in the valley below them. The first was a gradual shelf, then came the steep drop-off to the river bottom, which mostly lay out of sight because of the view angle. The edge of the drop-off was marked by overlapping blast rings with black scorch marks at their epicenters. Inside the circles, the concrete rubble had been swept clean of dust. Dead stickies and parts of same lay scattered around the joint circumferences. Beyond the litter of death, the blast rings were haloed with crimson. The bridge deck lay in a line of massive jumbled chunks on the ground, chunks that sprouted rusted rebar bristles. Amid the fallen blocks, about 100 yards away, the hapless motorcycle crew had made camp for the night. It was also where they made their last stand. Immediately, Ryan caught frantic movement among the concrete slabs. A pair of Norm survivors were being circled and set upon by packs of naked muties. Other stickies played tug-of-war with the corpses of fallen bikers. And that wasn't the worst part.
Nuke in hell!
JB leaned over Ryan's shoulder and pointed. 75 yards away, dense black smoke poured up from a pile of off-road motorbikes. They were completely enveloped in flame.
At the edges of the blaze, spindly-armed muties gyrated with abandon. Empty, plastic jerry cans of gasoline lay scattered at their feet.
Stickies loved fire, almost as much as they loved senseless killing. 8 of the muties were shoving the remaining 4 dirt bikes toward the conflagration by the handlebars and rear cargo racks.
Go! Go!
Ryan thumbed the right rear of the Stire's receiver, sliding off the safety and peering through the scope with his one good eye. He could have opened up on the muties attacking the survivors, and maybe, just maybe, driven them off, their defenseless victims, before they were torn to shreds. But if he had done that, the last of the motorcycles would have surely burned. And the motorcycles were the companion's only way out. Ryan held the crosshairs low to compensate for the down-angled close-range shot. He took a stationary lead on the sticky pushing the front of the first motorcycle, aiming at the head. As he tightened the trigger to breakpoint, the companions were already skidding down the bike trail to his right, beelining for the pyre. Through the optics, Ryan saw his sticky target bowled over. When it went down, it took the bike down too, in a cloud of beige dust. Ryan swung his sights to the right. The daisy chain of bike-pushing muties was so focused on the bonfire that they didn't run for cover. They just lowered their hairless heads and pressed onward. Ryan touched off a second round and downed a handlebar sticky at the base of the neck, shattering its spinal column. The nearly beheaded muty bounced like a rag doll off the handlebars and fork, flopping to the ground on its back. The rear pusher couldn't hold the dirt bike upright. Ryan watched it topple over onto the downed sticky's legs. From below the bridge, the rest of the companions began firing. Around the bonfire, struck by a hail of slugs, the sticky dancers jerked to a brand new beat as they were hurled backward into the blaze, where they briefly thrashed, fried, and died. Suddenly sealed off from their goal by a row of weapons, the bike-pushing stickies stopped in their tracks. As they dumped the motorcycles, the last muty in line spun toward the campsite, toward its brother-sister creatures, who were merrily disjointing dead traitors and tearing off their flesh in strips. Already locked on target, Ryan snapped the cap. The NATO slug slammed the sticky sideways and down. The mortally wounded creature dervished in the dirt, arms flapping, legs kicking. The other muties abandoned their sport and scurried to the edge of the rubble field, regrouping for an attack on new victims. Closing fast on the dropped motorcycles, the companion spread out in a skirmish line and fired at will. JB shot from the hip, Mildred from her Olympic stance, both with deadly effect. Smoke and flame belched from Doc's ancient blaster, lead balls blasting through sticky chests and backs as they turned to flee. JB and Doc quickly booted the corpses off the bikes, while Christy, Jack, and Mildred used speed loaders to recharge their wheel guns. In front of them, 50 or more muties massed behind a slab of bridge deck. Ryan's pre-dark rifle was no longer an option. Slinging it, the one-eyed man vaulted for the side of the road in the crude bike trail. The downslope was close to 60 degrees, and the path practically a straight line. He half-skied, half-fell 150 feet to the bottom and hit the ground running, yanking his Sig Sauer from hip leather. At the same instant, the stickies broke from cover and rushed the 5 companions, who had closed ranks to concentrate the effect of their weapons. Doc started the fusillade. A yard of flame and gout of black powder smoke belched from the muzzle of the Lamaze top barrel. A fraction of a second later, the others cut loose. Under the rippling smack of bullet impacts, the center of the sticky front wave crumpled and folded. Half of the closely following second rank crashed to earth as well, unable to avoid the sudden tangle of legs and torsos, which momentarily, at least, saved their wretched lives. The third, fourth, and fifth rows of attackers split down the middle and veered around their own fallen, like a torrent flowing around a boulder field. As they reformed their inhuman wave, the companions' weapons roared again. At near point-blank range, the companions' cross-chest barrage swept the stickies off their bare feet. Ryan advanced on the muty flank, holding the Sig Sauer in a solid two-handed grip. Ryan punched out rapid-fire center body shots as the tripped muties tried to scramble to their feet. A round punched through a scrambler and slammed the runner behind it in the side of the head. The others dashed past like they had blinders on, even as Ryan blew their packmates to hell. Suddenly, the Sig Sauer cycled empty. There wasn't enough time to dump the Sig spent mag, reload, aim, and fire at the stickies veering his way. Shifting the pistol to his left hand, Ryan whipped his 18-inch Panga from its leg sheath. He glanced to the left as Doc fired his Lamar. Along with a plume of caustic smoke, it spewed forth a combination of broken glass and pot metal fragments that Doc called his facelifter load. At a range of 10 feet, that's exactly what it did. It was his last shot. Doc immediately unsheathed his kingstick sword, neatly sidestepping to avoid an oncoming sticky. With surgical precision and speed too quick for the eye to follow, the point of his rapier blade opened a second grinning mouth, 3 inches below the spike-rimmed maw the mutie had been born with. Also out of cartridges, JB used the barrel of his M4000 scattergun like a short club to bash and smash the heads of the monsters that lunged for him, beating back the horde, providing cover and time for Christy, Mildred, and Jack to reload. Ryan's Panga cleaved the air, hardly slowing when it met muty flesh and bone. The sight of their fellows falling in pieces under the bloody blade didn't give the stickies pause. Stepping around another set of outstretched sucker fingers, Ryan swung the Panga so hard that he sliced off the top of the sticky's head, front to back. Half a loaf of pale crosscut brain flopped to the ground, followed by its stone-dead former owner. Their weapons loaded, Mildred, Christy, and Jack rejoined the fray. They split up to get clear firing lanes, then headshot the last of the surviving stickies at close range. Ryan surveyed the scene, alert for any other movement. His shirt dripped pink from his pouring sweat, mixed with sprays of sticky blood. Wiping the Panga's blade on his pant leg before he scabbarded it, the one-eyed warrior turned sharply toward where they'd seen the traitors being torn apart.
Start up the bikes. You come with me, Doc.
Doc nodded as he sheathed his sword. Ryan dropped the Sig spent mag into his palm and swapped it with a full one from his pocket, and the two of them trotted for the remains of the traveler's campsite. Sitting astride the machines, JB, Mildred, and Christy goosed their respective throttles to redline. When Ryan looked back, he saw Jack stomping the fourth bike's starter pedal, throwing his whole weight against it over and over again.
This way!
The two men hurried past the campfire pit, and the traders abandoned fully loaded backpacks. Suddenly, Doc stopped short, his expression aghast.
Sweet blessed charity!
Chill me! Please chill me!
This came from a ruined hulk of a human being. He lay on his back on the ground in the lee of a tipped-up slab of concrete. Most of his clothes had been ripped away.
Please!
Ryan could see bloody molars and moving tongue through the huge hole torn in his right cheek. He had been scalped as well, down to the shiny white bone. His right foot faced the wrong way, still in its duct-taped patched boot. The other foot was missing altogether. His left arm hung semi-detached, torn from its socket, hanging by a thread of golden sinew. Smeared sticky adhesive had sealed off the ruptured major blood vessels. The poor broken bastard wasn't going to bleed out. Not anytime soon.
End it! Use your blaster!
Doc gave Ryan a questioning look. The one-eyed man minutely shook his head. Their bullets were in short supply, and the route to safety too long and too precarious. He pointed at the steel pommel and worn leather handle of a knife sticking out of the rubble. In the heat of battle, it had fallen out of the reach inside of the mortally wounded man. The K-bar's blade had been sharpened so many times, it had been reduced to a steel sliver. Doc used the point of his rapier to flip the knife closer to the wreck of a human being. Without pause, without a nod of thanks, the traitor grabbed the combat knife and, propping the pommel on the ground, held the blade's tip below his sternum. He rolled over hard onto the knife, driving the long steel through his heart and into his chest to the hilt. After a moment of convulsive quivering, his body lay still. A faint morning breeze swept down the river valley, carrying with it an awful odor. It wasn't coming from the dead man.
Do you smell that, Doc?
Spoiled herring?
Then the truth hit Ryan. Without a word, he turned and dashed for the chasm. Doc loped after him. As Ryan looked down over the edge, into the riverbed, his stomach dropped to his boot soles.
That's not rotten fish. It's spunk.
Lord have mercy.
The bottom third of each of the bridge's massive supports was crawling with mating stickies. Hundreds of them. They clung to the sides of the pillars, crawling, squirming over each other, like bees in a hive. Ryan realized that the dirt bike track ran right past the foot of the pillars in the puddled genetic muck before it crossed the dry riverbed to the other side. The breeze lifted his hair gently, and Ryan froze as he realized it was headed straight to the downwind mutants. As he watched, the smell of spilled blood roused the writhing, hip-thrusting masses from their rut stupor. The sticky slowly started to disengage and descend the ladder of slippery bodies to the ground. They would follow the blood scent like a homing beacon.
Quick, Doc!
Waving Doc after him, Ryan raced back toward the campfire. When they got there, they shouldered as many of the loaded backpacks as they could carry. As Ryan ran from the rubble field, he saw Jack still trying to start his motorcycle.
Leave it! Come on, over here!
The albino youth let the machine drop to the ground. Mildred let him take her bike, and she climbed on the seat behind JB. Christy rode over on hers, and Doc and Ryan jammed a couple of backpacks in the cargo rack, then battened them down with bungees. There was no time to check the contents.
Gaia, what's that smell?
Hundreds of stickies copulating.
While Ryan and Doc were tying down the backpacks, JB thumped high brass shells into the loading port of his M4000 as fast as he could. When the mag was plugged, he passed the scattergun back to Mildred. Ryan climbed onto the seat behind Christy. He adjusted the stire strapped across his back, then unholstered his SIG.
Stop for nothing. All we've got going for us is speed and surprise. That means staying on the existing path. If we try to break fresh trail and go around them, we might dump the bikes. If that happens, they'll swarm us and we're dead meat. Okay, let's go!
The armorer screwed down his fedora, then roared away with Mildred pressed against his back. As Christy and passenger Ryan and Jack and passenger Doc followed, the lead bike vanished over the verge of the chasm. Christy slowed a little to keep from going airborne when they hit the drop-off. As soon as the front wheel pointed down, she opened the throttle wide in second gear. The slope was steep, the dished-out path worn smooth. Along with the gut-wrenching acceleration, wind howled past Ryan's ears and whipped at his clothes and his one good eye. As Christy hurtled toward the sticky-covered pillars, Ryan leaned to the side and glimpsed Mildred standing on the dirt bike's foot pegs, her knees bent, left hand firmly gripping the back of JB's coat collar. Holding the scatter gun by the pistol grip with her right, she aimed straight ahead. The spray of close-range buckshot momentarily cleared the road of obstacles, exploding a sticky's head like a liquid-filled pinata. Hunched over the fuel tank, Christy shifted to third and wound the engine to redline, leaving Ryan's stomach far behind. Firing his weapon was out of the question. He couldn't do anything but hang on. If the muties had thrown their bodies at the bikes, they could have made them crash. Suicide in the service of killing was certainly in their repertoire. Before the strategy could occur to them, though, the six companions were already past the pillar bases in a screaming blur. Dead ahead, JB's brake lights flashed on. The bike shimmied as it slowed, and Mildred sat down hard. Coming up on them too fast, Christy hit her brakes too, then downshifted an instant before they bounced into the riverbed, skidding across the loose stream gravel. To keep her from laying down the motorcycle, Ryan slammed down his left boot. Feathering the throttle and the brake, Christy regained control and righted the bike. Then she rocketed them up the much more gradual incline on the far side of the riverbed. When Ryan glanced behind, he saw Jack powering up the slope through the dust cloud they had raised. Lanky Doc was perched on the seat behind Jack, shoulder-length gray hair and the tails of his frock coat flapping in the breeze. With his boots propped on the foot pegs, Doc's knees were level with Jack's shoulders. Ryan thought they looked like a carny act. At the crest of the grade, there was nothing but open road ahead of the companions, sticky free and string straight. Unable to contain his glee, JB accelerated away from the others like a madman. Holding down his treasured hat with one hand, he threw back his head. Under the wide brim of a straw planter's hat, Oki Moore squinted through rubber-armored mini-binocs. Behind him, fixed to the rusting rail, a tattered homemade Lone Star flag snapped in the onshore breeze. From his vantage point atop the Yokomaru's radar mast, some 12 stories above the main deck, 5 stories above the roof of the wheelhouse, almost 400 feet above ground, he could see 20 nautical miles. The cheap Taiwanese optics were never quite in focus. If one eye was sharp, the other was slightly blurred, but they were good enough to spot a telltale blip along the seam between white-capped gulf and cloudless blue sky. So far, there was nothing to see, but the combination of fuzzy images and the glare of the midday sun had given him the beginnings of a monumental headache. It felt like someone had inserted a flexible steel rod up his right nostril and then corkscrewed it through his sinus passages until the pointy tip bored into the nerves behind his eyeball. Oki hadn't slept for 24 hours, not since the trader's sloop beating in from the southwest had dropped sail and coasted slowly through the sheltered anchorage on the Corpus side of the island, the black plastic trash bag pennants on its headstay fluttering like dying crows. From the cockpit, through a megaphone, the skipper shouted a warning to the beach and the handful of moored ships. The three-man crew had seen Brownsville from a distance. It was a funeral pyre, set alight by the Mattachine. When the Nuevo Texicans had tried to get the ship to stop, it had hauled out, leaving the Padre Islanders to meet their fate. After the observation and gun posts that ringed the perimeter had been alerted, the heads of the Nuevo Texican founding families and their lieutenants, Oki included, met in emergency session in the Yokomaru's windowless galley. They had planned to dump the fire talker on the mainland shore that very day. Now they didn't dare. There were unanswered questions about how he had managed to reach Padre so quickly on foot. If he was a pirate spy and they turned him loose, he could report back on the island's fortifications and armament. Some of the headmen wanted to kill him at once, just to be safe. But when a vote of hands was taken, they were in the minority. The majority decided it was better to keep him alive and close, as he might give away an impending attack, either inadvertently or under torture. The Nuevo Texicans had beaten back invaders on many occasions in their short, violent history, usually before the bastards even set foot on the beach. Streams of triangulated gunfire from strategically placed attack posts took an unholy toll on shore landings. The threat of long-distance shelling by the Mattachine meant that their normal defensive tactics went out the window. The Nuevo Texicans couldn't count on the attack posts surviving a high-explosive barrage from offshore. The only hardened defensible structure on the island was the cargo ship itself. In stacked containers and vast below-deck holds, it held virtually all of the islanders' wealth. It was decided that when the enemy was sighted, they would withdraw the island's population to the freighter and make the attackers take it, deck by deck, bulkhead by bulkhead. If the Mattachine shelled the ship to break the resistance, they'd destroy everything they came for and waste precious ammunition in the process. Absent-mindedly scratching an angry cluster of mosquito bites on the inside of his wrist, Oki turned on the platform and gazed down on the foredeck at lines of people carrying valuables and food into the ship and heading back empty-handed for more. A natural incline made of compacted, wind-driven sand led from the beach to the portside gangway. Before the pirates landed, and after everyone was on board, they would blow it up, forcing the Mattachine to use grappling hooks and ladders to reach the top deck, which would put them squarely into the kill zones of the firing ports staggered along the hull. The narrow slits hacked into the steel were just big enough for ramp and post sights and gun barrels. Looking down over the crow's nest rail, feeling the rickety platform sway under him in the wind, Oki had an awful surge of vertigo. Heights normally never bothered him. He shut his eyes for a moment, and when the whirling sensation passed, Oki once again peered through the binocs, scanning the lines of people filtering between stacked cargo containers for his two hugely pregnant wives. He didn't see either of them, or any of his 6 kids. Everybody who could fire a weapon was carrying one. Women and the older children wore AKs and sawed-off pump shotguns slung across their backs. There were no tear-streaked faces. The islanders, to a person, were jut-jaw defiant. They had all heard other fire talkers' stories about the Mattachine, selected, fragmented details that were, of course, calculated to entertain and raise the short hairs. There was no way of telling if any of them were true, or how much the facts had been exaggerated. It was rumored that the pirates all carried machetes with razor-sharp cane hooks at their tips, gut rippers. It was said they used the heavy blades to chop off any hands raised against them. They then nailed the severed appendages in pairs to the ramparts of conquered vills, palm outward, in a gesture and symbol of permanent submission. Even as the residents crisscrossed between the Ville and the Yokomaru, explosive charges were being laid in the narrow, winding paths between the shanties. The pre-dark Claymore mines, with their payloads of steel ball bearings, wouldn't be tripwired and armed until the enemy came into view, and the last of the women and children were safely on board the ship. Oki raised the binocs, taking in the bow of the vessel. Surrounded by a rapt, deck-seated audience, the fire talker was perched on a bit, waving his arms and talking animatedly, giving the droolies more to slobber about, no doubt. The islanders' usual practice was to securely tether the triple stoops, staking them at least 3 yards apart, to keep them from playing hide the slime eel. In camps elsewhere in the Deathlands, these unfortunates were not so tenderly cared for. The moment the symptoms surfaced, the slack lower jaw and vacant stare, heads were smashed in. The Nuevo Texicans kept their little flock alive, not out of compassion, but because the droolies were so damned amusing. Besides, having someone around visibly more messed up than you made a person feel instantly better about him or herself. At least I'm not a droolie, was the unspoken but ever-present refrain. Even though it was around 80 degrees out, Oki was struck by a sudden chill that started at the base of his spine and rippled up his back and neck and crab-crawled over the top of his scalp.
Shit.
As the shudder passed through him, the steel rod behind his eye probed deeper into the nerve bundle. He saw bright, dancing spots of light and once again felt his stomach churn. Worse, there was a simultaneous, uncomfortable pressure building deep down in his bowels.
Had to be something I ate.
Underdone rat on a stick, maybe. Closing his eyes and gripping the rail in both hands, Oki tried to will the sensations away. He still had another couple of hours before he would be relieved of the watch. The seated droolies rocked their hips, scooting their behinds on the deck in time to the gleeful chant. Daniel DeCipio sat back and basked in their adoration. They couldn't get enough of his backstories and technical explanations, although it was unclear if they understood a single word of the complex scientific and philosophical concepts that underlaid his narratives. Still, the frenzied attention buoyed his spirits. From the Yokomaru's bit, Daniel surveyed the squat little ville spread out below. Construction had started in the most weather-protected spot, in the lee of the freighter's bow. The first cluster of single-story huts used the ship's hull for their rear walls. Building materials had to be salvaged and ferried from the flooded ruins of Corpus, so subsequent structures shared both side and rear walls. Nothing in the ville was straight. Not roofs, not doorways, not lanes, not side yards. Everything was made of accumulated scrap, unpainted or covered in peeling layers of paint. That said, the grounded container ship's bounty had provided every ramshackle hut with its own Taiwanese knockoff Weber kettle and fancy barbecue tools, and its own plastic lawn furniture. The Nuevo Texicans were damn proud of their little corner of the world. Daniel DeCipio, 20th century Freezy, had a different perspective. A shithole by any other name. He surreptitiously watched the people hurrying to protect their little town, for the initial subtle signs of infection, a growing restlessness, a flushing of the face, a sensitivity to light. He visualized the viruses invading individual host cells, commandeering reproductive machinery, replicating until their sheer volume burst cell walls, then spewing forth in a torrent, hardwired to penetrate and infect new cells, an unstoppable rising tide of the submicroscopic, leading to debilitation, agony, and horrible death. All of which derived from the poison that lurked in his 137-year-old blood, and to which he was happily immune. Whenever Daniel reflected on what had led him to his most peculiar fate, the answer was always the same: the blind pursuit of art. It was what had animated and enthused him since the third grade, when he started reading and collecting various pulp action series from secondhand bookstores. He had pored over the Golden Age titles until the yellowed, musty pages dropped from the bindings, absorbing the nuances of style and content. All Daniel DeCipio had ever wanted to do was to write adventure books like those. Doggedly determined, he had eventually achieved his goal, but in the 20 years between his introduction to pulp and his first sale of a novel, the industry had changed. Serious action fiction had become a franchise operation, produced by hamster-wheeling, faceless ghostwriters. It was, in effect, a dead-end career. Slaughter Realms, the house-owned pulp series he had slaved upon for 7 years, had had several nameless authors and had run to well over 250 titles. All nagging questions of artistic control and continuity had been resolved by Armageddon, by more than a century of elapsed time, and by his unlikely survival. Even before the new cost, individual books in the series had been forgotten, consigned to landfills and bonfires, and along with them, Daniel's contributions to the canon. He had come up with gem-like signature exclamations for two of the main running characters, Ragnar the Viking and Nav Lysum, the wilted but defiant patriarch of the Celery people. In return for his devotion to his art, Daniel DeCipio received no author credit, an hourly wage well below the established national minimum, and no royalties on book sales. The turning point for him had come on March 13, 1998, when after finishing his 29th book in the series, he had asked the publisher for a $100 raise and was denied. Crushed and mortified, for the first time, Daniel actually considered abandoning his lifelong dream. He considered becoming a realtor. If he had taken that career course, he would certainly have perished along with almost everyone else in the U.S. on that January day in 2001. But in a moment of pure inspiration, fueled by the depths of his outrage and despair, Daniel had decided to do something truly radical in the name of his craft, for the sake of fresh experience, of something truly unique and exciting to write about. Without a thought to the possible consequences, not that even he could have imagined them, he had thrown himself into the meat grinder of science. More than a century post-Nuke Day, the world's values had taken a hard U-turn, and a turn for the better as far as he was concerned. The idea of bottom-rung fiction, or bottom-rung consumer merchandise, lost all meaning when there was nothing left for either to be compared to. Which is why the cargo of the Yoko Maru was worth fighting and dying for. A self-guided sightseeing tour of the island's shantytown had told Daniel what was stored in the container ship. White running shoes aplenty, wardrobes of summer fashion, circa 1999, and plastic lawn furniture. But also, toothbrushes and toothpaste, toilet paper, linens, bathware, and canned goods in profusion. Empty tins of pork and beans, peas, pearl onions, peaches, black olives, and potted meat lay scorched in the camp middens, as well as cast-off plastic packaging from barbecue potato chips, honey-roasted peanuts, jerky sticks, cookies, and candy bars. Daniel had seen bagged charcoal, car batteries, spark plugs, fan belts, flatware, dishes, pots and pans, stuffed toys, cooking oil, and grooming and beauty products. There was also a variety of made-in-India, factory-loaded ammo, 9mm Parabellum, 7.62mm Russian, and 12-gauge low-brass quail loads, among others. Apparently, the Yoko Maru held a large stockpile of pre-dark centerfire munitions. As he had prattled away on automatic to his spellbound audience, Daniel took in the islanders' highly organized defensive preparations, the lines of people moving on and off the ship, the self-sacking of the Ville. They had a good plan, obvious but good. From the hard looks he was getting, they suspected him of something far more nefarious than rotting the minds of ghoulies, as if their suspicions mattered at this point. The fight for the island was already lost. The Nuevo Texicans just didn't know it. Yet.
All right, but this is absolutely the last time today.
After the companions had motored 3 miles up the road, Ryan signaled for a pullover and parley. As the dust settled around them, Christy, JB, and Jack killed the motorcycle's engines, and everyone dismounted. No longer in motion, they felt the full impact of the sweltering heat.
Okay, let's take a look at what we've got while we have some breathing room.
JB was the first to dig into one of the looted backpacks.
Well, looky here.
He held up a plastic-wrapped, gold-colored brick for all to see. Taped to the outside of the kilo of C4 was a sealed blister pack that contained blasting caps and electronic trigger, radio detonator, and two sets of lithium batteries, one to set off the cap, one for the remote detonating device. As a backup, there was also a coil of thick white blasting cord. Ryan and the others quickly dumped out the contents of the other five backpacks. There was no ammo, no food, no water. Just pre-dark plastic explosive and detonators. There was enough plastic piled in the middle of the road to turn a square city block into rubble. Mildred turned a block over in her hands.
Well, we know the stuff still works. The stickies found that out the hard way.
JB took the brick that she handed to him and read the text on the packaging. His eyes widened as he passed it to Ryan.
Check the address.
What is the significance of the label?
Back in the day, when JB and me were running with Trader, there was a rumor going around about a pre-dark industrial plant in western New Mex, where the government used to turn high-X into C4. Supposedly, the finished product was stored in deep, blast-proof bunkers in the desert. Looks like our dead scrounger stumbled on the motherlode.
Phew! Where's Big Jack?
Jack towed the pile with a boot tip.
To the right buyer. The trouble is, we're a long way from the nearest baron.
It's still worth plenty to a middleman. We've got to find someone who has what we need, short-term. Ammo, food, water, and gas for the bikes. If we can trade away a small part of the stash, we can haul the rest of it east, where it'll bring the most Jack. Check the fuel in the bikes.
They unscrewed the gas caps, and JB peered inside each of the tanks.
Fuel levels are pretty much the same. Not enough to get all of us to Louisiana, that's for sure. If we're lucky, we can get maybe another 20 miles before we start to run out. Red blasted stickies burned up all the extra gas in their victory dance.
And we're gonna have to detour south to trade for bullets and supplies.
Why south? Beaumont is due east on this road. We've easily got enough gas to get there. Couldn't be more than 10 miles.
Beaumont is a no-go.
Yeah, it was hit hard on Nuke Day. Nothing there but glow-in-the-dark rubble and twisted steel. Trader always gave it a wide berth and beelined his convoys for Port Arthurville on the Gulf Shore. If the headman down there is still the same, he's a thieving pile of crap.
A giant thieving pile of crap.
But it's still the closest place to swap some of the C4 for what we need.
Jack used a hand to shield his unsettlingly red eyes from the glare as he looked up the road.
Port Arthurville, maybe 30 miles.
If the companions had been riding solo, Ryan knew they might have made it on the little fuel they had. They wouldn't split up, though. Not of their own volition. Mildred glanced at JB.
How much water have we got?
The armorer produced a scarred 2-liter plastic bottle from his backpack. It was half full of a cloudy, slightly brown-tinged liquid. There was a layer of fine sediment at the bottom. Ryan took the container. The sun beat down on his head and shoulders. The heat sang in his ears as he held it up for all to see. Christy tilted her head, dismayed.
That's it?
That's it. We can drink it all now, or we can drink it later. What's it gonna be?
Later, when we really need it. We'll be okay for a bit.
Okay, then. Let's pack all this stuff up and get moving.
About an hour down the road, JB lost power first. As he dropped back, his engine went dead, and he and Mildred coasted to a stop. Christy and Jack braked their bikes and turned back to join them. Ryan swung off Christy's back seat.
I make it we're still 5 or 6 miles from the edge of Port Arthurville.
Too far to push the bikes in this heat with so little water.
Motorcycle's valuable, all right, but they aren't worth taking the last train west for. Not when we have 60 kilos of operational plastic to trade.
Jack, scout ahead and find us a good spot to hide the bikes. If we can barter some gas in Port Arthurville, we'll come back for them later.
Doc dismounted from the motorcycle's rear seat, and Jack sped away. The others stretched their legs as the minutes ticked by. Soon the team rode back.
Gulch behind a rock pile. Not see you from the road. Quarter mile up.
They abandoned the three motorcycles in the shallow ravine, about 100 yards from the edge of the ruined 2-lane highway. It was a good location, and they could easily find it again from the sandstone outcrop. Before they set off, they shared the last of the water, which amounted to a couple of good swigs per person. The companions left the gulch, lugging one extra backpack each, a about 25 pounds of additional weight. It took them almost 3 hours, walking at a steady pace, to reach the outskirts of Port Arthur. They smelled the Ville long before they saw it. The faint sea breeze carried a raw stink of sulfur. As they advanced on the southwest horizon, the skeletal rusting ruin of the Predark oil refinery came into view. Its storage tanks had ruptured long ago, spilling their precious contents into and poisoning the surrounding soil. The wide street in front of them was lined by tangled fallen telephone and power lines and jumbled poles. The few houses that remained standing sported caved-in roofs and buckled or bowed walls. In the aftermath of Skydark, countless Category 5 storms had bored inland from the Gulf. Across the panorama of decimated flatland, the companions were the only things moving. Port Avil's residents had retreated like dogs into the deep shadows. The brutal heat of the day was something best slept through. The farther south they walked, the stronger the brimstone odor got. To a discerning nose, it was as much swamp gas as petrochemical, the odor of wet rot and mold. It was coming from the direction of Port Avil's waterfront downtown. Along the former Gulf Intracoastal Waterway, which paralleled downtown, a motley fleet of trader sailboats were moored to the bases of partially submerged, rusting loading cranes. A blonde barefoot boy, about 14 years old, in a holdout t-shirt and shorts, popped out from behind a cinder block foundation and cut across the deserted street in front of them. He struggled along with a 5-gallon bucket of water, trying not to spill the contents, as he headed for a small cinder block structure. Metal roofed, windowless, and one story, it looked like a power company or road maintenance shed. The only door had been crudely sawn in two horizontally. The Dutch door was a way to get some air circulation. The top part of the door was open. The inside looked dark and dank, and blistering hot.
Hey, kid, how about a drink of that water?
The boy stopped, turned, and put down the heavy bucket.
Well, give me a shot, Chill.
A broad figure appeared above the maintenance shed's Dutch door, stepping from darkness into the light. Naked from the waist up, Mama held a rusted foldstock AK-47 pointed skyward, her finger resting on the trigger guard. She was a big woman with stringy brown hair, huge flabby arms, and massive breasts. Cradled in her other arm, a baby contentedly nursed on one of her dirt-blotched, stretch-marked dugs.
That's the price! Pay it or fuck off!
That's outrageous, Ryan.
Shh, Christy. I know it. I hate like hell to give up a shell, but damn, we need water. We need clear heads for the haggling later.
We'll pay it. Give the boy around, GB.
The armorer ejected a live shell from his scattergun. He handed it to the kid, who checked the primer and shook the shell next to his grimy ear. His eyes lit up, and he smiled gap-toothed at his mama, who waved the battered AK at the companions.
Well, go on then.
The companions took turns at the bucket, drinking their fill. The water was sweet, cool, and fairly clean. Just as Christy finished her drink, standing up to wipe her mouth with her arm, the filthy woman behind the door shot her a contemptuous glare.
You think you're better than us, don't you? Fuck you, bitch.
Christy's prehensile hair coiled with anger, and Ryan grabbed her arm, gesturing for everyone to continue on their way. After they got a few buildings away, Mildred glanced back.
Friendly town, isn't it?
Make no mistake about it. This isn't your run-of-the-mill hell pit. This is the rad-blasted end of the line, the last outpost on the Gulf Coast before the Dallas-Houston death zone. Folks don't end up in Port Avil by choice. They end up here because they were driven out of the Eastern Baronies on account of who they were or what they did. I'm talking about the lowest of the low. Diseased gaudy sluts, jolt fiends, cold-heart robbers, and crazy chillers. The traders who come through here specialize in looting the interior's hotspots and robbing the scroungers who got there first. They're used to taking the biggest risks. Keep your eyes open and your weapon hands free. From now on, we're on triple red.